Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. It's open forum. We continue with the open forum. We've had awfully nice callers so far. So this would be a really good opportunity if you're not a nice caller to get on, because we've overdone the nice callers and we need some rotten mean callers. So if that's you and you want to
I got to warn you, Cy. Yeah. I see at least one solid nice caller in the mix, Sean from Fort Perry, Canada. The regular caller, he's also Canadian. You know he's nice.
Oh, he's probably going to be mean to me, though, because I said that Canada was sending all their smoke down to us. So
yeah, it's like we send lots of good things. Maple syrup?
Maple syrup, smoke.
Any of your best celebrities? Yeah, John Candy?
I know.
Alex, you're back?
Canada, just for John Candy. We should be eternally grateful to Canada.
One of my favorite movies as a kid was Canadian Bacon, where he envisions Canada invading America or something. It's funnier.
No one's ever heard
Canadian.
Of that movie. Don't talk about things nobody's ever heard of.
Speaking of things nobody likes, hey, want to tell us about your terrible joke?
Oh, I will. I'll tell you my joke. All right. So it's actually a Norm Macdonald joke, and who's one of the funniest human beings that ever lived.
Your joke is not even you. Okay.
No, it's not my joke, but I heard Norm Macdonald tell it, but he used to make up bad jokes. Like he would write bad jokes on purpose and it was funny when he would read them. But this one I think is the funniest thing I've ever heard. And everybody I tell it to says, it's not funny at all. You should stop saying it. Are you ready?
Well, I'm bought in. Yeah.
All right. Please. Here's the entire joke. I wonder who's buried in the grave of the man who invented the old switcheroo.
That's a good joke. I'm sorry to say. I did not see that coming. That was a good.
Yeah, I don't know why that makes me. I think that's so funny. And you're the only person who's ever laughed at it. You're my best friend now, Joe. You're my best friend, you know. Now you can't get out of it.
Believer just listening and saying, Christians are so dumb. These Christians are so dumb.
Yeah, no, there's lots of Christians with good taste and manners. Just our lack of them should not dissuade you from embracing the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
All right, enough of our address to unbelievers to start the show. The number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. I forget what I was supposed to do. Did we finish that last call on Wiccans? We did. So I can go to another call now? Or was there something else you wanted to say about Wiccans?
I think so.
Okay. All right. No.
Yeah, I mean, we covered confused. The basics. Don't be a witch.
Okay. All right. John in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Thanks for the call, John. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Well, one, I'm a nice guy. Two, I thought the joke was very funny.
Yes! You're two for two.
You know, just saying the second thing would have already shown the first one.
Yeah, right. Merciful anyway.
I have a lot of pity for unfunny people, but I really like your joke.
Well, I'm still laughing. So we have a society of St. Pius X parish here in town. And as I understand it, not all, but some of the sacraments you receive there are considered valid, but they're all considered illicit. And I don't know the difference between being valid being illicit.
Okay.
That's a good question. A valid sacrament means the sacrament actually happened. An invalid sacrament. So if you come over to my house and I'm saying, I'm going to celebrate Mass now, then I hand you bread and wine. I've only given you bread and wine because I cannot validly consecrate the Eucharist. And so that would not be valid. And it's not a question of just, I mean, it also is forbidden for me to try to. So it's also illicit, which just means forbidden. But a priest can validly consecrate the Eucharist. But in some circumstances, he's told not to, you know, if it's not in full communion with the Catholic Church or, you know, for various other reasons. In those situations, he's still a priest. He can validly do it. He's just not supposed to do it here. There's a good, it sounds to many people like weird legalism. And I always point them to the same place. I point them to Numbers chapter 20. A little bit of context. The Israelites are in the desert and there's not a lot of water in the desert. And so at one point, God has Moses strike a rock with the staff and water comes out. But then they keep going in the desert. There's still not a lot of water in the desert. And so they're complaining about God. And God says to Moses, take the rod and assemble the congregation, you and Aaron, your brother, and tell the rock before their eyes to yield its water. So he's very clear. Just speak to the rock. Show them that you don't even need the staff. You can just hold the staff and speak to the rock. And Moses is like, now I know hitting the rock works, but I don't trust God that I can just speak to the rock. And so he goes and he ignores the instructions. And instead, he strikes the rock with the staff again. It was illicit. He did what he was forbidden to do. He did not do the thing he was told to do. He did a different thing instead. But remarkably, water still comes out. God still works through this miraculously. He then punishes Moses for his disobedience, but the Israelites are able to receive the water that they need. So that's the kind of distinction between a valid but illicit sacrament, is that God can still work through it to give people graces that they need, but the person being disobedient is still punished for that.
So as a follow-on to that, if I attended Sunday Mass there, would that fulfill my Sunday obligation?
That's a good question. There is a little bit of ambiguity about this. My Archbishop just said yes, and so I feel comfortable with that. But you should ask your bishop. Having said that, he also said he discourages his people from doing it, and so I would respect that as well. So unless there was some situation where I couldn't attend any other Mass, you know, where it's like, well, the roads are really bad for whatever reason, I live close to this SSPX church, that would be about the only circumstance I think I would do that in if I'm trying to fulfill my Sunday obligation. You should do it in a way the church encourages you to do it. Like, you don't want to test the boundaries of obedience. That's not a good spiritual disposition, would be my suggestion. That even if you can get away with it, you don't want to get in the habit of saying, how far can I go without crossing the line?
John, I'm going to leave it there because there are, as I've said, all the lines are full. So, and quite a few international calls coming up. So I'm going to keep moving. It's open forum. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Thank you, John. Going to Manila, Philippines. James in the Philippines watching on YouTube. I know there's probably more than one person named James in the Philippines, but is this our old friend, James?
This is the old friend, James.
Well, welcome back, James. We're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Joe. So
Hi.
My question, so I've been reading the book of Job lately, and you know how difficult his situation is, well, or was,
yes.
But there are certain verses or chapters where Job expresses a desire to be hidden in God's cave until his anger subdues or to sleep. And so my question is, I guess, twofold. First, why should we believe that these verses in Job are incompatible with the idea of soul sleep? And secondly, how did people prior to Jesus or prior to the New Testament understand and expect eternal life?
That's a good question. So the first thing is, there's a degree of successive revelation in regards to the afterlife. So when we say prior to Jesus, it depends a little bit when we're talking about. So in later parts of the Old Testament, the ones closer in time to Jesus, you have very clear proclamation of the resurrection of the dead and eternal life. For instance, in Daniel 12, it says that many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And that's very clear, right? That there will be a bodily resurrection. And those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. That's Daniel 12, but that's all later books. The earlier books are less clear about things like the resurrection and about the nature of eternal life. And this comes up in a really concrete way because there's a sect of Judaism, the Sadducees, who only accepted the first five books of the Bible. And so we're told in the New Testament that they don't believe in the resurrection. They don't, not just like they don't believe in Jesus's resurrection. They don't believe there will be a resurrection of the dead. Well, why not? Because they don't see it in the first five books of the Bible. Now, when they confront Jesus about this, he tells them they're ignorant of the scriptures, and he points to them from the Torah, the first five books, that God describes himself as God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he says, is he the God of the living or the dead? So that's the first thing. We should say there's no one answer to what did people know and when, because God was revealing this in stages, and some people had a little bit of knowledge, and some people had more knowledge, depending on what century you're talking about and whether they listened to the later prophets. The second thing, in terms of soul sleep, there's a couple places I would look. One of those is in Luke 16, when you've got the rich man and Lazarus. And the rich man is in hell, or he's in a place of suffering. And Lazarus is in, he's described as being in the bosom of Abraham. And both of them are depicted as very much awake. So even though we talk about the body sleeping and we say things like rest in peace, that resting does not mean that your soul loses awareness, because all of the depictions show the soul being fully aware. Think about the angel, or the, excuse me, the souls of the just underneath the altar in heaven, described in the book of Revelation, who are crying out for God's justice. They're aware of what's going on. When he says to the thief on the cross, "Today you'll be with me in paradise," that's a weird fulfillment if the thief is with him and has no idea he's in heaven because he's asleep the whole time. And so the idea of soul sleep that's kind of enjoyed a resurgence since the Reformation is not rooted in a good understanding of the Bible, because we can talk about you sleeping in the sense of bodily death and also being awake in the sense of the soul being united with God.
James, how's that?
Because your body and soul. I should mention that part explicitly. You are body and soul. And so if you focus just on the body's asleep, fine, but the soul's not.
Gotcha. Okay. That was very helpful. Thank you, guys.
All right. Enjoy your morning, James.
Thank you so much.
You see, Joe, because it's morning in Philippines. Did you not know that, Joe? How that works?
I struggle with the fact that you're in a different time zone than me. So like it's very confusing. You know what I found myself doing? A very silly overcorrection to this.
What?
When I was in Fort Worth, I kept thinking, okay, what time is it at home in Kansas City? Is this a good time to call? We're in the same time zone.
I do that like when I go to Northern California sometimes. I'm like, okay, what time is it here in Northern California?
I do the math. Carry the zero.
All right, we'll take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features daily Mass, prayers, articles, and meditations in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church. On the web at Magnificat.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What have you always wanted to know about the Vatican? Well, I'm your Vatican Insider, and I answer that question when I bring you the news about the Pope, Vatican City, and I share insights and stories from a broad spectrum of church ministries.
Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis, Saturday night, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Talking to old friends today on Catholic Answers Live. Several old friends have called. Good friends. I don't mean old friends like they're old people. I just mean, you know, people that we...
But they're getting older.
We're all getting older,
we
Joe.
All are.
Let's go to Port Perry, Canada. Sean, listening on the machine that comes from Amazon that I no longer say on the air. Because it made a lady really mad that I said it one time. And I liked this lady, so I don't want to make her mad. But it's a machine.
Can you say it and then say, like, send PayPal $500 to Cy Kellett? Would that work?
No, because
I don't know.
That would be hilarious to me. But it's apparently not funny to the people who own the machine that has a lady's name and comes from Amazon. Hi, Sean from Port Perry.
Hello. You know all that smoke that you're getting from Canada?
Yeah.
Down in the United States? Did you know that we legalized marijuana a couple of years ago?
It makes sense now.
All right. It's all coming into focus at the same time that it's going out of focus, Sean.
Well done.
Thanks for the smoke, by the way.
I was going to make a maple syrup joke, but it was too savvy.
You're allowed to ignore him, Sean. We had a meeting and we agreed to that.
I was reminded by your discussion about the Council of Florence of what hopefulness there was for the complete reunion of all Christians in one church at that council, and how everything went pear-shaped afterwards. And It's related to my question, because there have been a number of occasions in the history of the church where things really seem to be falling apart, or actually were falling apart, but somehow the church survived. And for the past couple of decades, church adherence and church attendance has just been falling. And the number of recruits to priesthood and religious life have been falling. And I just wonder if you see any sign of some kind of revitalization in the future, the way we've had several times in the past.
Yeah. So I think I want to divide that question maybe in two categories. First, or what are the signs of life, or the positive signs we see within Christianity, since you mentioned Florence and unification of Christians? And the other would be just like people becoming Christian who aren't. I actually see a lot of positive signs in terms of Catholic Protestant and even Catholic Orthodox engagement, although I see it more, frankly, in Catholic Protestant engagement, that partly probably to the internet, certainly to things like the pro-life movement. Catholics and Protestants are often coming into encounter with one another in a way that hadn't happened in the past. And when you don't have any exposure to the group, it's easy for kind of falsehoods to set in. I heard a funny story about a Baptist who went to Russia, and he said when he told people he was Baptist, they asked him why he didn't believe in God, because they'd never met a non-Orthodox, and they just thought, oh. And obviously, that's not a good understanding of what Baptists believe. And likewise, there are a lot of falsehoods that float around about what Catholics believe in Protestant spheres. Actually, this coming Thursday, I've got a video coming out responding to a fellow by the name of Mike Gendron, who has 1 million YouTube views full of misrepresentation of the Catholic Church. He just constantly, but the beautiful thing about the internet is, even though those falsehoods can spread, so can response videos. So can, you know, corrections when people get things wrong, so that there's less vincible ignorance than there was in the past. Meaning, if people choose to be ignorant, they can. But they have more opportunities to not be ignorant if they want to avail themselves of them. That's a good sign. That's a good sign for atheists, a good sign for non-Catholic Christians, across the board. You can learn more things. And I'm seeing a greater understanding and appreciation of some of the Catholic distinctives. I'm seeing within Protestantism, in many corners, a desire for something a little liturgically richer than many people grew up with. And so they're looking for things like Lent and Advent and trying to recover the liturgical year. And so there is a hunger for a patrimony that had been lost and is now being recovered. So I see a lot of positive signs. I see many things like that are going on very well. In terms of the broader culture, I think things are going to get worse before they get better. Father Paul Cech. Thank you. Chris Cech is not a priest as far as I know.
He's a father.
The brother. Yeah, that's a good point. So Chris Cech's brother, Father Paul Cech, is fond of saying it's going to get darker before it gets pitch black. But I understand the kind of wry humor with that. But the truth is, as the culture gets crazier and crazier, so do the number of people who say something here has gone wrong. And when it becomes so self-evidently crazy, I think there's an opportunity for the church to kind of speak prophetically and boldly in that space. Whether we will or not is an undecided question. But the opportunity is to say, hi, the culture has gone off the rails here, and this is a real problem. I know, this isn't a Catholic thing specifically, although a Catholic made it, but Matt Walsh's movie, What is a Woman?, where he just asked people what a woman is. And one after another expert in the trans movement dodges the question, refuses to answer, or just calls the question rude. And it's really a remarkable emperor having no clothes kind of moment. And it has something like 175 million views last I saw, because Elon Musk shared it on Twitter and said, parents need to watch this. And it was huge. It's massive. And this is in spite of every mainstream news organization refusing to review it or talk about it or engage with it in any critical kind of way. just writing it off and hoping people won't know about it. So given all that, in spite of everything going wrong, I do see signs of life, and I do see the fact, you know, it's like this. Last comment. I know I'm going long on this. You were made by God with a hunger that only He can satisfy. And that there is this hunger within you for truth, goodness, and beauty. And everyone has that. The person with whom you disagree the most has that. And we can ignore it. We can try to fill it in bad ways, but it's not going to go away until it's met in God. You know, this is Augustine's beautiful insight in the Confessions. And so that is perennially true and gives us a great deal of hope, I think, that as the culture, it becomes increasingly obvious, has nothing to offer. Just nothing to offer our desire for truth, goodness, or beauty. No longer believes in truth, no longer believes in goodness, clearly no longer believes in beauty. I'm still hungry for those things. So where am I going to find that? And that's where we can step up as Christians.
Sean?
Yes.
Is that all right? That answer makes sense to you?
It's hopeful. I won't take up time responding because I know you have a lot of people waiting. Thanks, Joe. It's a hopeful insight that you have.
Thanks, Sean.
Good. Well, hopefully you're not too dour on it. I think we're called to be a people of hope, not, you know, naive like optimism, but true hope to know that even in the darkest moments, God still is in control.
Sean, it's always great to talk with you, and we look forward to the next time. And thank you for the smoke. We're going back to Canada. Colin's in Canada, listening on Catholic.com. Big Canada hour this hour. Hi, Colin. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi. First, I'd like to just say thanks to both of you for taking our question on Society 315 forum last week.
Cool. Lori, that was a lot of fun.
Wait, it was two of you, right?
Yeah, it was me and my wife.
I remember that one. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, you
he
did
was
a good
judging
job.
Your room. Do you remember that part? Did you want to respond to him? He made some comments about your room.
It's just that you asked a question about art. And the two of you are being filmed in front of a completely blank wall.
Because they wanted to know if they could get 3D printed art for their room.
But do you remember all of this, Colin?
Oh, yeah.
It didn't offend you, though. I don't think that offended you, did it?
I just wanted to stir the pot. Why not?
No, Joe's trying to get you to be offended at something I said. And it's just hurtful. I'm getting a little emotional here, Colin. Go ahead with your question.
Anyway, I thought I'd ask another art question. This might be a bit uncultured, but I notice in a lot of Renaissance paintings, especially of biblical events, it's pretty common to see things that people might call anachronistic, like armor, weapons, clothing that wouldn't be invented for like centuries after the event being depicted. Yes. I guess my basic question is there sort of like an artistic purpose to those sorts of things? And if so, is that something that we can do today still with our current architecture, clothing, buildings, weapons, those kinds of things?
Yeah, this is a great question because it's true. Frequently, painters would set biblical scenes in like the local countryside with the clothes of the day in which they lived. So if you were living in central Italy in the 15th century and you're trying to depict the angel Gabriel appearing to Mary, you're going to depict the angel Gabriel appearing to Mary wearing 15th century Italian clothes with like the local hills in the background. And there's something really beautiful about that. And you see this across the board. If you go to China, Mary looks Chinese. And it's beautiful. There's something about that where it's a reminder that the biblical message, and particularly the incarnation, is not just for one time and one people, but for all times and all people. Nevertheless, it did happen in a particular place, in a particular time, to particular people. So there's also something good towards trying to depict things historically accurately. I think in a lot of cases in the kind of Renaissance and Middle Ages, trying to depict the first century historically accurately would have been an extremely difficult task for an ordinary painter. But there are stories of painters going to the Holy Land to get a sense of the local scenery to try to make it more historically accurate. A great example of an anachronistic moment, although maybe not technically anachronistic, is St. Paul falling from a horse. Well, in Europe, that's what you would ride to get from point A to point B. But more likely, if you're going from Jerusalem to Damascus, you're going to be on a camel, not on a horse. And, you know, the Bible doesn't say which animal he was riding. But those kind of questions, you know, if you're a European medieval painter, you probably aren't envisioning a camel and maybe can't paint a camel because you've never seen one. So I think there is a practical dimension. There's also a theological dimension that there is a universality to the Judeo-Christian kind of message. But then the last part about, well, could we do that today then? Partly the answer is yes. I think the problem is that it comes off looking irreverent rather than timely and incarnational.
I got to have to leave it right there. We've got to take a break. Colin, thanks very much. It's Open Forum. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. All the lines full, so lots more questions to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Want to get right to the core of Christ's saving message? Want a roadmap for living the life Christ calls you to? It's time to look again at the Beatitudes. In his new book, Heart of the Gospel, How the Beatitudes Show Us God's Plan for Happiness, Father Sebastian Walsh demonstrates compellingly how these eight declarations make up the foundation, the essence, and the final goal of Jesus' teaching. Heart of the Gospel illuminates the scriptural passages from which we get the Beatitudes, explains the significance of their wording, their order, and their timing in Jesus' ministry. And it draws out edifying parallels and connections with salvation history and the lives of the saints. Most importantly, Father Walsh offers wise counsel from his own work as a priest and teacher to help you live the Beatitudes in your own life. Order your copy of Heart of the Gospel today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. 1 million people currently on the phone. So off we go to the phones. Josh is in Indianapolis, Indiana, watching on Twitch, which that's really cool. Josh, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, guys. Thank you for having me. So I was on TikTok, and I saw this guy who was just, I would say, a Protestant giving an exorcism to some dude on the street. And I was like, man, like, there, he's just fooling a bunch of people. And I was in the comments trying to, like, have a debate about it. And I just want to know, like, I know that the authority is given to, was given to the apostles, which then was given to the successors of the apostles. But what's, like, a better way to, like, explain that, like, from scripture and then, for, like, through history of the church? Because I would explain it and then give them the scripture, but they still wouldn't understand it.
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a couple distinctions that should be made here. One is the office of exorcist, and the office of exorcist is governed by canon law. Canon 1172 says that no one can perform exorcisms legitimately upon the possessed unless he has obtained special and express permission from the local ordinary. That means the bishop, usually. And the bishop is only to give the permission to a priest who has piety, knowledge, prudence, and integrity of life. Now, why is that? Because you don't want regular people trying to go toe-to-toe with the devil and then it going badly very quickly. If you remember the story in Acts where someone tries to imitate the miraculous exorcisms that he's seen, and the demon says, "Paul, I know you, I don't," and just, like, torments him. Because it's like, this guy had no authorization, no qualifications to do that. So there's an important sense in which the office of exorcist is sent out, not just in his own private capacity as a person who's spiritually enlightened or something like this, but with the authority of the church. And the church is very strict about who it will grant this authority to. Now, there's two other distinctions we need to make. One is that there is some history of lay exorcisms in the church itself. And so it's not unheard of in the past to have lay people performing exorcism. It is not seemingly something that one has to be a priest to perform an exorcism in the order of nature or in the order of like divine revelation, but the church in her prudence is very careful about who she allows to be an exorcist, given the spiritual danger of giving someone, you know, basically a giant spiritual weapon they don't know how to wield. So I would not go so far as to say it always has to have been a priest, because there does seem to be some evidence to the contrary. And then the last distinction is that there are what are called minor exorcisms as well as major exorcisms. You'll notice canon law is talking about an exorcism over the possessed. But technically, even like the rite of baptism has a minor exorcism, and those can be performed by the clergy or by the lay faithful. So there's an appendix in one of the sacramental books that includes a whole list of prayers that lay people can pray that are prayers of exorcism. But the rite of major exorcism can only be performed by a bishop or priest, and the priest needs special authorization to do it. The bishop can always do it. The priest needs the bishop's permission expressly to be able to do a major exorcism.
Got it. Okay.
And by the way, if you're trying to show this, a helpful case might be if someone is inclined to believe in such things. The USA Today story about the exorcism that happened in, I think it was Indiana. It was a Halloween story years ago. If you look up USA Today, Indiana exorcism case, it was a Protestant family. They went to the Protestants. They couldn't get the demons out of the house. They went to the priest. He tried minor exorcisms first, and it took the bishop authorizing him to do major exorcisms, and then the problem was solved.
Thanks, Josh. I'm going to keep moving because lots of folks on the line and lots of friends on the line, folks we have talked to regularly. Emma in Hayden, Idaho, one of those listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Welcome back, Emma.
Thank you, Cy. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
What happened to all the numerology stuff in the Bible that was so big in the 80s and the 90s? Did it just fizzle out? Is it real?
Ooh, tell me more of what you mean.
Oh, you know, like the number of people's names, you know, predicting things that could happen.
Yeah, like Bible codes, that kind of thing.
Yes, yes.
So, yeah, I remember as a kid, I was obsessed with Bible code stuff as a kid. This was, I think, much bigger in evangelical Protestantism. I never saw a Catholic book on this. I read multiple Protestant books on this, and I thought it was so cool. And then at some point, I think I realized, wow, I'm spending all this time reading these esoteric kind of codes about what the Bible words might mean if you arrange the letters every seventh letter, but I'm not just actually reading the Bible. And that's a problem, right? Like, that's something to watch out for. I think there's a couple things. First, there are numeric values to letters in Hebrew. And those numeric values can sometimes have a spiritual significance. There's one really clear instance of this. Revelation chapter 13, verse 18 says, "This calls for wisdom. Let him who has understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666. That the 666 is the total. It's not like the popular imagination is like the devil's is going to have like 666 or the beast is going to have 666 on his forehead or something. And that misunderstands what's going on. He's saying, if you want to understand who I'm talking about, think about someone whose name, the Hebrew numeric value for it is 666. And that's Nero. His name in Hebrew, right. That's what it totals. So the fact that there can be a numeric value and that might be significant that's all true. What is really implausible and borders on esoteric and superstitious is the idea that there's like a hidden code that we need to like decipher and crack. And I would just say that's contrary to the whole Christian understanding of Revelation, because God hasn't really revealed himself if instead he's just sent Morse code or, you know, some really complicated code that takes 2,000 years to crack. The notion of revelation is that he's not sending an impossible or difficult to decipher code. We have to read with wisdom. We have to read with understanding. But it shouldn't be something where it takes 2,000 years for a popular author to say, maybe if we do every seventh letter, we can find these like phrases. The last thing is, people who defend Bible code and stuff will say, well, you couldn't do this with another work of equal size and have the same result. And that's actually not true. Someone took War and Peace, and they found if you take every seventh letter, occasionally they'll have these strings where it spells out words. Of course it does, because you're just taking these common letters used in whatever language you're reading, and occasionally it'll form words. It'd be like if you decided to read the leftmost letter on the page. If you do that and just scroll down, occasionally you'll be like, oh, look, that formed a word. And so I would be very skeptical of this. The methodology is also very sketchy. They'll change what number they're using and all of this to try to get the word to work. None of that, there's no principled basis on which they're getting that. Like, it might be the seventh letter one day and then the seventh and then the 13th the next. For those who don't know Bible code, this probably all sounds insane. And it kind of, with the benefit of hindsight, I think it was insane. And so I think there's a reason evangelicals have also largely moved off of this, is that it has not proven accurate in predicting the future, and the methodology is so Gnostic rather than Christian.
Emma, is that all right?
Very good.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you. I can go to bed now.
Okay, oh, good. Oh, that is good. You're going to stay up all night, huh?
I've been up all night worried about this question, so I'm going to take a nap now.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's a nap at 5:30 in the afternoon, but yeah.
No, that's not a nap. That's just going to bed. That's just being old, bed, Emma.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. It does seem very much the most convincing thing. I mean, well, not the most convincing thing, but the thing that strikes me about what you said is this just doesn't comport with the way God does things. It's not the God that we know in the person of Jesus who would just be sneaky. He's not sneaking around trying to.
This is something the early Christians were actually really emphatic about, because the Gnostics were always talking about how, oh, Jesus has one set of teaching for the public and another for his secret disciples.
Yeah.
And the Christian response is like, no, that's not true. You know, when Jesus is arrested, he says, I was taught in the temple every day.
Yeah.
You know what I taught? Like, he's very clear. Like, my teaching was out in the open. And St. Paul, he says, these things were not done in a corner. Right. Like, this is, we don't need to go hunting, looking around for some secret theory to know what Christianity is all about.
No,
we can look to the largest church on earth publicly proclaiming these things, and a catechism is easily available. And, you know, you've got 2,000 years of the largest church saying, here's what we believe and why. And
right.
And you don't need to find somebody who's peddling. Look, if you hold the Bible upside down and shake it, you can get these words to come out.
Thanks again, Emma. Thank you very, very much for that call and for that question. Let's go to Ricky in Bellevue, Nebraska, listening on Catholic.com. Ricky, thank you for waiting. Excuse me. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, guys. Thank you for taking my call. Joe, you may not remember it. A couple months ago, I got a chance to talk to you about the papal states in regards to military power. And I had asked you a question. My question was, if I became Catholic, could I reject just war theory? And you said yes, but you said there's good reasons to believe it. So my question today, with, you know, in 5 minutes, if you can, is kind of a two-parter. Number one, what reasons do you have for support of just war theory? And does just war theory contradict the Sermon on the Mount?
Beautiful. Ricky, I'm grateful for that question.
Well-worded question. Everyone else listening, this is how you do it. No, I'm just kidding.
No, also, this is just so important for our time. I'm so glad that you asked that question, Ricky. Thank you.
I can't remember. I might have told you this last time, but an essay that's really helpful is by Elizabeth Anscombe, or G.E.M. Anscombe.
Yeah.
Gertrude Elizabeth Margaret, I think, Anscombe, called War and Murder. And her point is that if you say all killing is murder, if you say all war is unjust, you seem to be doing a good thing, right? You're setting the moral bar really high, but that invariably what's actually happening is you're making the moral bar unreachable. And then in those situations, people just end up acting really immorally because they've decided they can't act morally, because you've made it so impossible for someone to live according to the gospel that now they're just like, okay, well, in that case, I'm just going to, you know, everybody fails. You know, if killing an animal is murder, and if you were to, like, hypothetically, right, if you took meat as murder very seriously and said, the prohibition against murder includes killing any animal or a bug hitting your windshield or any of these things, then people would just say, well, I can't live out that. So nobody's perfect. And then they would just go ahead with murder. But if instead you say, no, intentionally killing a human being is wrong, an innocent human being, like, we have all these modifiers and caveats on it because we want an absolute and universal rule. And that's only preserved by having a well-nuanced kind of rule. And so that's her point, that trying to go above and beyond the moral code of the Bible sounds noble, but invariably ends up being unworkable. And so you'll notice, for instance, in Luke chapter 3, soldiers approach John the Baptist, and he says, they say to him, what shall we do? And he says to them, rob no one by violence or by false accusation, and be content with your wages. He doesn't say it's immoral to serve in the army. There's none of that. Now, in light of the Sermon on the Mount, some Christians have voluntarily chosen for themselves to go above and beyond and say, I will personally embrace pacifism. If I'm attacked, I won't defend myself. If my house is robbed, I won't fight back. But you can't impose that kind of rule on anybody else. You can't force somebody else to that kind of non-Christian moral code, that kind of non-Christian standard. In the same way that you might say, I'm going to be celibate for the kingdom, but I can't force everybody else to say no one is allowed to get married. I don't know. Does that make sense? Does that help? You don't want to make the moral law unreachably high, and you don't want to bind things that Christ has loosened.
Ricky, what do you think?
Yeah, I do. And remember now, Joe, you brought up that Elizabeth Anscombe article, which I have yet to read. So I'll definitely have to take a look at that. I was wondering if I could maybe, I know you guys are pressed for time, but I was wondering if I could interact with you just for a second on that, Joe, if that's possible.
Sure.
Yeah, but yeah. Let's do this. Let's take the break because I got to take the break. Okay. And so, but this is really important and I want to come back to it. Can you just hang on a 60 seconds or so, Ricky?
Yeah, absolutely.
Guys. Okay, good. We'll talk about war and peace from the Catholic perspective with Ricky and Joe right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN is everywhere. EWTN radio programming is provided free of charge to over 500 domestic and international AM and FM radio stations. It's a great teaching tool for Catholics and non-Catholics alike. For a complete list of EWTN AM and FM stations across America, visit EWTNradio.net. At the bottom of the page, click Affiliates. EWTN, the global Catholic network.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Ricky, I want to just say something to you that I was saying to Joe at the break, that I sense in the Catholic community around the world, but particularly here in the United States, a growing discomfort with our kind of acceding to the various wars and the great amount of violence of the last couple decades, that there seems to be in the Catholic community a sense of, did we and have we been following the gospel, or have we been kind of worldly in not objecting to some of the violence that's been done? Does that strike you as correct, what I'm saying? Ricky, maybe you're also part of that reevaluation of the public use of violence, and that may be at the heart of some of your questioning?
Yeah, some of it. Most of it is just kind of studying the Anti-Nicene Fathers and seeing a lot of evidence for what I would say as pacifism in regards to joining the military and just killing in general.
Okay.
So that's why I'm kind of
If I can maybe add a point on that, one of the controversies in the early church on joining the military is that they started to demand an oath to Caesar that treated him like God. So apart from the question of violence, there was a question about the military having become a tool of quashing Christianity.
Okay. Yeah. No, but yeah, to your point, Sai, I think that does make sense. And I look at it as somebody that I want to take seriously the claims of the Sermon on the Mount.
Amen.
In regards to kind of what Lewis said in regards to love, not affectionate feeling. It's being I think it was Aquinas that, you know, it's the ultimate good that we can achieve for somebody as far as it can be obtained, kind of thing.
Well, I would just like to second your commitment to there's nothing that we believe, nothing that we undertake and call moral can conflict with the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is not optional. So it not just seriously, gravely, it requires our grave attention to what Jesus is giving us there morally. But you wanted to interact with Joe a little bit on the just war theory. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask if I could just play the fence on one of the statements that you made, Joe, because I know it's common for a lot of people in regards to like John the Baptist or Jesus in regards to, you know, soldiers coming to him and him not saying, that, hey, being in the military is immoral or anything like that. So there's kind of an argument from silence, not saying it's a bad argument from silence, but argument from silence nonetheless. But I hear people on the opposite side, some of my pacifist friends that will make the claim that, well, you don't have anywhere from Jesus where he tells a tax collector to stop cheating people out of their money. And you don't have him telling any prostitutes to stop hooking, you know, so could the same.
Well, that's only sort of true. He tells the woman caught in adultery, go and sin no more. When Zacchaeus, the tax collector, comes to him, he promises to make amends. Jesus doesn't tell him to, but it's clear that there is a repentance from the action of defrauding. Mm-hmm. And when the soldiers come to John the Baptist, he does tell them not to defraud. So one could read this and clearly say prostitution and defrauding are obviously moral evils that aren't consistent with faithful discipleship. But you have not just silence with the centurion. You actually have in Matthew 8, him holding up the centurion as a model of faith. And Elizabeth Anscombe actually makes the same analogy your friends are making, but in the other direction, saying it would be hard to imagine him going to a madam of a brothel and saying, what a model of faith this woman is. That, you know, this is not just a soldier. This is someone who commands soldiers. And yet Jesus is putting him up in Matthew 8, which doesn't seem consistent with the idea that Jesus was secretly a pacifist. He's certainly pro-peacemaking. He's also pro-mercy, but that doesn't mean that he would be against something like a criminal justice system.
Okay. Yeah. I appreciate that. And I'll definitely check out that. I take it that article's free online.
It is. I was able to find it in the course of our conversation on filledpapers.org. So hopefully you should be able to find it. If not, you've got the number and I'd be happy to keep the conversation going. I think it's really good. I went through a period where I strongly leaned in a pacifist direction. And there are great figures in the church like Dorothy Day who have much stronger pacifist leanings than I do today. So there's a lot of room for thought on this. I just want to make sure that wherever you end up for yourself, you don't end up in a place where you're judging other people for not living up to a moral code that isn't really in the Bible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you. You give me a lot to think about, so I appreciate that.
Ricky, you've given us a lot to think about. And again, I want to say I'm grateful to this. I often think we get calls on all kinds of things, but the big questions of Jesus and money and Jesus and violence that are so basic to his ministry, we often don't have the opportunity to talk about. So I value that opportunity. Anybody else that ever wants to call on those topics, I hope you'll find that you get a good reception here because they're not so easy to answer and they're very much worth considering if we want to truly be faithful to Jesus and what he's called us to. So call back anytime, Ricky. I am going to go now to... where am I supposed to go?
Harold in Maryland.
Did that just switch on me? Did he just switch that on me?
Yeah, I think I've got more time to answer his question.
Okay, Harold in Maryland.
I'm a little worried about the last two. They're
listening on that machine that you can get from Amazon. Go ahead with your question, Harold.
Yeah, sure. I guess. My question is in regards to the happy fault that we sing in the Easter liturgy. So I'm trying to figure this out. I have something of an answer in my mind, but I'm not sure. I just need some clarification. But what is it exactly that we had before the fall that we lost, that we gained even more than what we had? Like, would we?
Yeah.
What we lost, would we have gotten that before the fall? Would that God have given that to us before the fall? You know what I mean? Like, if it's a share in sanctifying grace, would he have given it to us anyway? If man hadn't fallen, would he have given us that? Or
it's a very, very good question that we have not been given an answer to. So the question is, if Adam and Eve had never sinned, would they still enjoy the divine life promised in the beatific vision? And we don't have a direct answer to that. We can say that Christ came into the world as a remedy for sin, because he's very clear about that. The Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. This is why he's here. He comes as the divine physician to seek the sick and the lost. And so we're able to proclaim in the Exultet at the beginning of the Easter Vigil, O truly necessary sin of Adam, destroyed completely by the death of Christ, O happy fault that earned so great, so glorious a Redeemer. What we're saying is, because of our sin, God came into the world. So imagine, this is a silly analogy, but you might imagine a relationship where you have a fight, and then you make up with each other, and you end up even stronger than you were before. And so you say, oh, I'm really glad that happened in a certain way. You're obviously not happy about like the worst of the fight, but you're happy that there was a process of healing and redemption. And so that's even more true at the divine level, that we're not happy with sin. We take very seriously St. Paul's claim in Romans 3 that where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. And he points out that you don't want to then say sin is good. He says, why not do evil that good may come, as some people slanderously charge us with saying. And then he says their condemnation is just. Like, we're not saying sin is good. We're saying, wow, even in the face of the worst things we ever did, God responded to that with an incredible outpouring of his mercy and grace. We don't have access to the world in which we didn't sin. And we don't know how he would have responded to Adam and Eve had they lived sinless, perfect life. But we do know what we experience if we live a holy life now in heaven through salvation is greater than anything Adam and Eve ever enjoyed in the Garden of Eden. Like, heaven is greater than the Garden of Eden. And we know that they were not owed heaven while they were in the Garden of Eden. So we don't know what would have happened to them because we never got there. But we do know that God has responded to sin by raising us to an even higher position than the spot we fell from.
I guess my problem is, my confusion is in regards to this theory that Christ would have come even if we had not fallen. Which is, it's like, I guess it's a Franciscan idea.
Bonaventure says that Christ would have come anyway, because he would want, because in the incarnation, it's not just that Christ takes away sin, but there's a union of divinity and humanity that happens in the person of Jesus Christ. And we benefit from that union of humanity and divinity. And so the question is, like, what would happen if we hadn't fallen? And again, we don't know. So there's, you know, C.S. Lewis explores this in his Space trilogy. I think it's the second of the three books. He imagines an unfallen world and then Christ coming to it. That's an interesting kind of hypothetical and thought experiment. But I want to really stress, we don't have access to that world, which is why Aquinas and Bonaventure can disagree on the question and no one knows who's right.
Okay.
Harold, that does it for us. You could probably hear the music in the background. That means we have come to the end. What a sad time whenever you have to say goodbye to Joe Heschmeyer. What a sad time. Oh, thanks, Joe, for you. Two great hours.
Yes, only too happy to join you guys.
All right. Well, tomorrow we got open forum again, right? It's like so much open forum. You can call and ask anything you want this week. And I'm pretty sure Jimmy will be here because it's Thursday. And Jimmy generally joins us on Thursday. So am I getting a nod? Yes. All right. We'll see Jimmy tomorrow. And we'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.